This podcast was recorded at Hartford Street Zen Center, Isanji, in San Francisco. Please help support our temple by making a donation at hscc.org.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm very happy to be back with you again. The drive from Santa Cruz this morning was really very beautiful. The air crystal clear and the hills near Stanford are turning green already. I hope the rain continues. And please forgive me for my informal clothing today. It's certainly not my intent to be disrespectful of you or the temple or Neil. It's just more a reflection of my poor planning. I didn't get my kurumo back from the cleaner on time. I'm sorry. I hold y'all in high respect. I thought I'd talk this morning about what I'm studying it with my Sangha in Northern California in Humboldt County. We've been studying the Diamond Sutra, and particularly in relationship to Zazen. No surprise. So we've been discussing what is it that actually happens during Zazen, and using a couple of models that are floating around out there on the internet right now. One model focuses completely on what's happening with the mind, and you know, all of us will recognize that we spend some period of time with the mind wandering, some period of time in any Zazen period with some rumination going on or craving going on. And every once in a while we have some experience of concentration, of actually being with the breath and being with the sensations. Sometimes more effort involved in being able to concentrate like that, and sometimes it comes really quite easily. Just some open awareness that's not particularly fixed on anything even. We also have a tendency, I've discovered talking with my Sangha there, to have more or less orientation toward objects, like people we may be thinking about or the events of our lives. All of those could be considered objects. So an object orientation, and certainly a tendency to make real or to make substantial things that are not necessarily real or substantial. And the verb that one of these models uses for that event is called reification, making something real. And on a scale, we might also, it's a little counterintuitive, but make effort toward de-reification, where that is to allow the natural transiency of something to emerge, to let it de-reify right before our eyes. In any case, in Zazen, we have a tendency to kind of fixate on what the mind is doing, and we have a tendency to evaluate that kind of open awareness meditation or concentrated meditation might be better than mind wandering, or might be better than ruminating. But the truth is that all of it happens simultaneously, and might be within our awareness or not, but it all happens simultaneously. So there's a whole other realm going on while we're in Zazen, and that is there are these other people in the room. So whether we're recognizing it or not, there's this transpersonal event. And if we look solely at the sensory part of it, I have the organ of my eye, And in the world, there are things that are seeable. And the interaction of the seeable with the organ of my eye, we call seeing. We could generalize that to any of our sense experiences. So it really takes 16, is that right? No, 18. If we think of the sense organs, eyes, ears, nose, tongue, touch, mind, and therefore the seeables, the hearables, the tastables, and the interaction of those with our organs, that's 18. It takes kind of 18 events just to be able to perceive. So I think of this in the realm of sensory experience, kind of even before the conceptual mind labels it pure sensory. Anyway, we have a tendency to fixate on what the mind is doing. We might have mental chatter, mind-wandering, but under that, there might be something a little bit more subtle, like ruminating on a past event. And under that, some unresolved feelings maybe about that past event. And under that, a phrase comes to mind, a poet during my college years. I don't even remember the whole poem, but this line is, "In the depths, poetry rages." Very powerful. If I consider under the mind wandering and under rumination and under feeling and under the poetry raging, something else is actually quite stable and pure. So if we evaluate that our zazen is not such a good period, if we've been busy with mind chattering, we're kind of off the mark, you know? So the evaluation itself leads us astray. What I really want to say about that is that it's just normal human activity. So where we get into trouble is when we reify. We tend to make things solid that are not actually so. So an example for me. The Diamond Sutra, you probably will recognize that it's the one that the Buddha is interacting with Subhuti. Subhuti has posed a question. If good men and good women want to give rise to the ultimate, most fulfilled, awakened mind, how should they stand? How should they move? And how should they control their thoughts? That's the question. And the Diamond Sutra is Buddha's response to that question. But it really is confronting Subhuti with this event called reification. So, even at the beginning of the Diamond Sutra, it starts with the phrase, "upon a time." And almost without fail, when I read it aloud with a group, sometimes we read it aloud from beginning to end, it takes us a little over an hour. And I encourage you, if you haven't yet done that, to do that, especially in the company of others, because it's one of those sutras that can become a little bit confounding and circular. That it is this, it's not that, therefore we call it this. It gets hard to follow if we read it alone and quietly, or if we read it just in bits and pieces. But if you read the whole thing through, the logic is really, really clear. And it's actually funny. There are jokes hiding in it. But you don't get them until you read it all the way through all at once. Anyway, so it starts with, "upon a time." And almost without fail, I see the word "upon" and "time" and say, even though my eyes are reading "upon a time," my voice says, "once upon a time," whether I want it to or not. And I think this is a little residue from my many years of having taught public school and read children's books aloud, once upon a time just kind of pops out. So that's a way, that's a very simple example in which my past conditioning meets the event called seeing, and out comes once upon a time as a reification. Very simple. So seeing these things, it's pretty clear how automatic and how subtle reification can be, and therefore how attentive we have to be in order to begin to dismantle it. We have the habitual, and we have the training of our culture to solidify, concretize, want more, want better, want different. So, the Diamond Sutra, in response to Subhuti's question, first point is that there's no separate existence. We would recognize that. That's part of our doctrine. And the next point is act with generosity. So there's no separate existence. And very next thing, please be generous. Give rise to pure and clear intentions with the mind not dwelling anywhere. So, of course, we kind of have to relate to our experience with what we've seen before, but we don't have to be limited by that. So the function, as I observe it, the function of the mind is to remember, analyze, predict. We don't have to be apologetic for what the mind does. We just have to recognize that we're not limited by what the mind does. We have a tendency to reify. And how do we do that? How does that actually occur? We do it by filling in the gaps with the activity of the mind. It's, based on my past experience, I expect to see, therefore I see. So, if someone in the past has been rude to me, I probably am bracing myself for them to be rude to me again. And therefore, I create a situation in which they're rude. What a surprise. Not necessarily so, but that's the tendency. I'm evaluating my notes and deciding which way to go. We will leave a little bit of time, of course, for conversation, but also a little bit of time to have a well-being service for the events in Paris, our solidarity with that suffering. And I'm evaluating my notes, deciding which way to turn here. Maybe I'll give another example of the way in which I reify, and it might prod some interesting conversation. Not too long ago, in my Santa Cruz home, I was installing a light fixture as the days turned shorter. We wanted more light. So I found this, I asked an electrician to help me find, and found, a light that is photosensitive. It'll turn on at dusk and off at dawn, and it'll give just the right amount of light. It's LED. Sweet. It's only going to cost pennies a year to run. I took this person's advice, I bought it, I wired it, I installed it, and at dusk the first day, it turned itself on, and I was, that's cool, it worked. And then within about 30 seconds, it turned itself off. And I'm like, my first reification was, that electrician steered me wrong, you know, so I went to blame, first step. And then my next step, my own reification, my own tendency to self-depreciation. Well, that electrician knows what he's talking about, probably. I think I probably just installed it wrong. So now I'm taking the light down and checking the wiring. And the wiring was fine. I put it back up. There it is. Turning itself on. And then, within about 30 seconds, turning itself off. So then I had to take the step back. This is called dereification. Taking the step back. And what I observed was this light I had installed kind of close to a ceiling similar to this, but under eaves. So it was reading its own light and turning itself off. And then it was like, oh, it's dark. I'm going to turn on. And now reading its own light, I'm turning itself off. It's turning itself off. And so on. So it was really just fulfilling its function. It was just doing exactly what it was designed to do. And here I had tripped out blaming somebody or criticizing my own work. So it's so subtle and it happens so fast. It seems like automatic. But we can catch these moments and take the step back, and then we can dereify. The other tendencies of mind to remember, to analyze, to predict, even mind wandering, ruminating, none of these things are problematic for us. Our problems occur. We might even say this is where our suffering has its root, in the process of reification. So, one of our teachings says that we have the pivotal opportunity of human form. We can notice our tendencies because we're human, and we can self-reflect because we're human. And then, this is the crux of the matter, we can, using the definition of karma, kind of typically in the West, we think about karma like cause and effect, because this happened, that happened. That's not untrue, but there's a bigger picture to it. And that is, karma is translated as volitional action. Literally, that's its direct meaning. And so if we use this definition of karma, now, because of practice, we can't not have had these experiences. Here you are practicing. It's part of your life. So you can't not see these things anymore. Now we have the option of acting, observing the results of that action, evaluating how did that go, and then adjusting to be consistent with the vow. New action, new results, new evaluation, new adjustment. This is karma. This is volitional action in action. The Diamond Sutra is sometimes referred to as traumatic. That's pretty dramatic language to call it traumatic. That's Red Pine's word. Red Pine is a Westerner, a translator, a scholar, teacher. And he calls the Diamond Sutra traumatic because it really challenges Subhuti, it challenges all of us to undo, unlearn our preconceived notions and adjust our behavior accordingly. So it's not so radical to hear that there's no permanent self. It's not so radical to hear that we should start with generosity. But this undoing preconceived notions and acting accordingly is really pretty radical. I had to look up the word radical. I have a basic understanding of it, of course, just like anybody else, but I had to look it up. Radical could mean just not according to the norm, or it could be a social or political view, or it can be simply meaning very basic, or important, like root words, or in mathematics, square root, or the cubed root. The cubed root of 27 is 3. Roots, they are very basic or very important. So if we look at the Diamond Sutra as radical, is it very new and different from what is traditional or ordinary? Yeah, because it makes us unlearn preconceived notions. Is it extreme socially? Does it have a social view that is not shared by most people? Well, yeah. Most people are, at least in the West, not thinking generosity first. Mm-hmm. So it's radical in those two meanings, and it's also radical in that it's very basic and very important. This is the root of the whole works. It's very traumatic for Subhuti, and maybe for us as well. Kind of turns us upside down and inside out all at the same time. We call something this, but it's not really that. But we call it that provisionally, maybe for the sake of convenience. So, an apple. We can call it an apple, but we know an apple is really the fruit of a blossom, the roots of the tree, bringing up minerals and water, the sunlight, all of those components, and the vast nature of all of those components are in this fruit that we call apple. So apple is apple, but it's not really apple because it's all of that, but we call it apple, at least provisionally. That's pretty radical. I have, to close here, I have a poem by Mary Oliver. For whatever reason, well, I know the exact reason. 2 weeks ago at Santa Cruz Zen Center, we did a skit night. And sometimes in skit nights, there are actual talents being exhibited, and sometimes it's just goofy. And at this particular skit night, somebody brought back a couple of songs from something we had produced for Catherine, now deceased 3 years, but when she had been there at Santa Cruz Zen Center for 10 years, we did something called Catherine Thanis the Musical. And some of the songs had the tunes of familiar musicals like West Side Story or Oklahoma, but with new words associated with them. And one of the songs was set to the tune of, is it 10 days or 12 days of Christmas? 12, right? But we did 10, the 10 years of Santa Cruz, of Catherine in Santa Cruz. In her first year in Santa Cruz, Catherine said to me, just sit and follow your breath. And her second year, please be on time, just sit and follow your breath, and so on. And her fifth year, read Mary Oliver. So ever since that skit night, I've been drawn to Mary Oliver. So I brought you this poem anyway. And this poem is called Percy. Mary Oliver, the great Dharma teacher. And what she's proposing here is as radical as the Diamond Sutra. This title is Percy Waiting for Ricky. Your friend is coming, I say to Percy, and name a name. And he runs to the door, his wide mouth in its laugh shape, and waves, since he has one, his tail. Emerson, I'm trying to live, as you said we must, the examined life. But there are days I wish there was less in my head to examine. not to speak of the busy heart. How would it be to be Percy, I wonder, not thinking, not weighing anything, just running forward? With gratitude to Mary Oliver and to Catherine for teaching out of Mary Oliver for many years. Maybe you have some comments for each other or questions engaging habitual states of mind, or yes?
So I struggle always with the, I'm trying to remember the word you used, I think you said undo, or maybe unwind or undo, or
Unlearn.
Mm-hmm. Those sound like things for me to do. Mm-hmm. They sound like things for me to do and undo and redo and assignments and actions to take and lists to write and process to implement.
It's hard to do that. But actually, you're wearing a rakusu, you've taken a vow, you know? Mm-hmm. You don't really have any other choice. Because I'm guessing, I don't really know you that well, I'm guessing that if you took a step back and tried to relax from unlearning, mm-hmm. you probably would receive the respite of that moment and then want to try again. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I think. You know, for me, I'm a doer, so for me, the biggest challenge is to not come up with more things to do, to just, you know, mm-hmm. to more be the empty space in which things rise and fall without, you know, tinkering with the rest, because I'll tinker with the rest of it until I exhaust myself.
Yeah. Well, isn't that right? You're pointing at the very fine line between this more, better, different thing,
yeah.
like needing to fix it,
yeah.
yeah, or simply being with completely. This is on the practice side. Being with completely and grounded in this under that business. So that the appropriate response arises all by itself. Not with any attachment on results. That's the trick.
Easier said than done, I was thinking.
Indeed. Yes. Hector.
I appreciated your comment about the apple itself. Growing up, my dad's mother, my grandmother, spoke a Wichol, American Indian language, and it was always so entertaining the way that she would reinterpret a lot of newer technology that was being brought in. My father brought in a VCR, mm-hmm. right? And her reaction to it was, wadi wadi te wadi wadi, which is the big box that eats the small box. and you know, I think that that's kind of a unique portion of everything, that there's so many ways to perceive a single objects.
Yes.
And the problem is really getting attached to just one yes. perception or one way of seeing it.
Mm-hmm.
Your comment about the apple itself brought that back.
So your grandmother, speaking Wichol, is teaching the Diamond Sutra as well. You know, it is this, but it's not this, but we'll call it this provisionally, just because we need to be able to talk to each other. Yeah, yeah. Thank you. There. Do you all know the? You know, yes.
Yes, you can go ahead.
The writer named Annie Dillard, do you know her? Beautiful nature writer. Her book, The Pilgrim at Tinker Creek, from many years ago, she wrote this passage about people who were blind, and surgeons figured out how to either restore their eyesight if they had had it once, or to give them eyesight. And she describes the surgeons and the families watching their family member see for the first time. And in this particular passage, she's a child. A little girl visits a garden. She is greatly astonished and can scarcely be persuaded to answer, stands speechless in front of a tree, which she only names on touching it, and then as the tree with lights in it. You know, whatever the conditions of her, she didn't even know what she was seeing until she could recognize it by touch, and now, oh, this is a tree with lights. We're constantly challenged to allow this perceptual field to open and broaden. Neil, your comment.
It's a false dichotomy, but even so, especially in circumstances such as we have today, somebody might think, well, on the one hand, there is this archaic Buddhist scripture in the Dhyana Sutra, and on the other hand, there's a ghastly massacre in Paris.
Yes.
What do those two have to do with each other?
Are you posing that as a examination or a real question?
Do you have a thought on that?
Mm. You know, the Diamond Sutra teaching us question your assumptions. If I were to summarize it in a more contemporary phrase, question your assumptions. So, worldwide, people are causing people pain. Even within our own families, with our own loved ones, you know, causing suffering, perhaps inadvertently, but nonetheless, and across the world. And this suffering that we're generating in this manner is based on assumptions that we're making about each other, and now our responses. Do we really need to otherize? Or what do we need to do to protect without otherizing? I think that's the contemporary application of the Diamond Sutra. Based on our conditions, we would say, oh, that's terrorism and those people. Really, are we brave enough to look at it with fresh eyes? It's a profound inquiry that you're bringing forward, Neil. How do we apply the ancient teachings to contemporary life? I would say that's my primary concern. I don't doubt, I have great faith in this actually, I don't doubt that from the settled position of our practice, even knowing that it's transient, momentarily settled, with the vow in front of us that we're about to chant, I have some faith that the right action and appropriate action reveals itself. Thank you. It's a provocative question, impossible to answer. I want to make sure we have time for our little service. Is there anything else on anyone's mind? Yes.
Yeah, I was thinking about the Paris incident, all night, all day. Also just how we sometimes practice and we're, you know, even caught in our own little delusions, or we sit down, we have these thoughts and we're ready to, you know, move, you know, thinking that we're moving forward with them, and then we realize they're just thoughts and it goes away, and there's this fine balance that we're dancing with, you know, or I feel like I'm dancing with my own practice of, you know, being present and not necessarily dislocating my delusions. It's just part of who I am, you know, but not necessarily to feed into it and cause, you know, events to happen afterwards. I feel horrible about, you know, what happened last night and the people that even packed themselves up with bombs and how they're thrown into this delusion, you know, thinking that they're doing something in the name of religion. And it's just, you know, we're all walking a fine balance.
Yes.
And some of us, unfortunately, because that's just the way of the world, some of us are thrown into even difficult circumstances to be able to go through life without hurting other people.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, one of the primary teachings for us is recognizing delusion. We might have an intuitive or a broad understanding, and it's not to say that that broad understanding excludes delusion, but rather that that broad or intuitive understanding includes delusion and recognizes delusion as delusion. So with that, because of practice, we can go, all right, on a global scale, what shall my response be? On a local scale, how shall I work for social justice, for example? And on the very personal scale, getting up from the cushion today, what shall be my first act of generosity? We don't have to wait to enact it at the global level or even local here in city and county of San Francisco. It can be your next generous act. Where shall it be? Yeah, we don't have to wait. I think we best close, and for the sake of time. I'm not sure whether, do I turn this microphone off or is it,
nice.
It takes care of itself.
Yes, it will.
And do we do the four vows?
Mm-hmm.